second Julia had planted a ticking time bomb that was going to blow up first Julia's life. That was December. By March, she and James were hanging by a thread. She dyed her hair black and painted her nails black in order to more accurately resemble the second Julia. James initially found this sexy and goth, and he stepped up his efforts in the sex department, which wasn't exactly a welcome side effect, but it made a break from talking to him, which was getting harder and harder. They'd never been as good a couple as they looked. He wasn't a real bona fide nerd, just nerd-friendly, nerd-compatible, and you could only explain your Gödel, Escher, Bach references so many times before it starts to be a problem. Pretty soon he was going to figure out that she wasn't role-playing a sexy, depressed, goth chick. She had actually become a sexy, depressed, goth chick. And she was enjoying it. She was dipping a toe in the pool of bad behavior and finding the temperature was just right. It was fun being a problem. Julia had been very, very good for a very long time. And the funny thing about that was, if you're too good too much of the time, people start to forget about you. You're not a problem, so people can strike you off their list of things to worry about. Nobody makes a fuss over you. They make a fuss over the bad girls. In her quiet way, second Julia was causing a bit of a fuss for once in her life, and it felt good. Then Quentin came to visit. The question of where Quentin had gone to after first semester was one she had an inordinate amount of trouble focusing her mind on, but the mist surrounding it was a familiar mist. She'd seen it before. It was the same mist that surrounded her lost afternoon. His cover story, that he'd left high school early to matriculate at some super-exclusive experimental college, smelt like first Julia stuff to her. Made-up stuff. She'd always liked Quentin, basically. He was sarcastic and spookily smart, and on some level, basically a kind person who just needed a ton of therapy and maybe some mood-altering drugs. Something to selectively inhibit the voracious reuptake of serotonin that was obviously going on inside his skull 24/7. She felt bad about the fact that he was in love with her, and that she found him deeply unsexy, but not that bad. Honestly, he was decent-looking, better-looking than he thought he was, but that moody boy-man fillery shit cut like zero ice with her, and she was smart enough to know whose problem that was, and it wasn't hers. But when he came back in March, there was something different about him, something otherworldly and glittery-eyed. He didn't say anything, but he didn't have to. He'd seen things. There was a smell coming off his fingers, the smell you got after they ran the really big Van de Graaff generator at the Science Museum. This was a man who had handled lightning. They all went down to the boat launch on the Gowanus Canal, and she smoked cigarette after cigarette and just looked at him. And she knew he'd gone through to the other side, and she'd been left behind. She thought she'd seen him there, at the exam at Brakebills, in the hall with the chalk clock, with the glasses of water and the disappearing kids. Now she knew she was right. But it had been very different for him, she realized. When he walked into that room, he'd buckled right down and killed that exam. Because magic school, that was just the kind of thing he'd been waiting to happen to him his whole life. He practically expected that shit. He'd been wondering when it was going to show up, and when it did, he was good and ready for it. Whereas Julia had been blindsided. She had never expected anything special to just happen to her. Her plan for life was to get out there and make special things happen, which was a much more sensible plan from a probability point of view, given how unlikely it was that anything as exciting as Brakebills would ever just fall into your lap. So when she got there, she had had the presence of mind to step back and make a full appraisal of exactly how weird it all was. She could have handled the math, God knew. She'd been in math classes with Quentin since they were 10 years old, and anything he could do, she could do just as well, backward and in high heels if necessary. But she spent too much time looking around, trying to work it through, the implications of it. She didn't take it at face value the way Quentin did. The uppermost thought in her mind was, why are you all sitting here doing differential geometry and generally jumping through hoops when fundamental laws of thermodynamics and Newtonian physics are being broken left and right all around you? This shit was major. The test was the last of her priorities. It was the least interesting thing in the room, which she still stood by as the reasonable, intelligent person's reaction to the situation. But now Quentin was on the inside, and she was out here, chain-smoking on the Gowanus boat dock with her half-orc boyfriend. Quentin had passed the test, and she'd failed. It seemed that reason and intelligence weren't getting it done anymore. They were cutting like zero ice. It was when Quentin left that day that Julia really fell off a cliff. It was fair to call it depression. She felt like shit all the time. If that was depression, she had it. It must have been contagious. She caught it from the world. The shrink they sent her to diagnosed her more specifically with dysthymia, which he defined as an inability to enjoy things that she should be enjoying, which she recognized the justice of, since she enjoyed nothing, though there was a world of space inside that should that a dysthymic semiotician could have argued with if she had had the energy. Because there was something she did enjoy, or would enjoy, whether or not she should. She just had no access to it. And that thing was magic. The world around her, the straight world, the mundane world, had come to her a blowing wasteland. It was empty, a post-apocalyptic world, empty stores, empty houses, stalled cars with the upholstery burned out of them, dead traffic lights swaying above empty streets. That missing afternoon in November had become a black hole that had sucked the entire rest of her life into it. And once you'd fallen past that Schwarzschild radius, it was pretty damn hard to claw your way back out again. She printed out the first verse of a Donne poem and stuck it on her door. The sun is spent, and now his flasks send forth light squibs, no constant rays. The world's whole sap is sunk. The general bomb, the hydroptic earth hath drunk, whither as to the bed's feet life is shrunk, dead and interred. Yet all these seem to laugh compared with me, who am their epitaph. Apparently semicolons were the hot new thing in the 17th century. But otherwise it was a pretty good summary of her state of mind. Hydroptic, it meant thirsty. The thirsty earth. The sap had sunk out of the thirsty world, leaving behind a dried husk that weighed nothing, a dead thing that crumbled if you touched it. Once a week, her mother asked her if she'd been raped. Maybe it would have been simpler if she said yes. Her family had never really understood her. They'd always lived in fear of her rapacious intellect. Her sister, a timorous, defiantly unmathematical brunette, 4 years younger, tiptoed around her as if she were a wild animal who would snap rabidly if provoked. No sudden movements. Keep your fingers outside the cage. As a matter of fact, she did consider insanity as a possible diagnosis. She had to. What sane person, wouldn't? She definitely looked crazier than she used to. She'd picked up some bad habits, like picking at her cuticles and not showering, and for that matter not eating or leaving her room for days at a time. Clearly, Dr. Julia explained to herself, she was suffering from some kind of Harry Potter-induced hallucination with paranoid overtones, most likely schizophrenic in origin. Except the thing was, Doctor, it was all much too orderly. It didn't have the quality of a hallucination. It was too dry and firm to the touch. For one thing, it was her only hallucination. It didn't spill over into other things. Its borders were stable. And for another thing, it wasn't a hallucination. It fucking happened. If this was madness, it was an entirely new kind of madness, as yet undocumented in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. She had nerdophrenia. She was dorkotic. Julia broke up with James. Or maybe she just stopped answering his calls and greeting him when they passed each other in the hall. One or the other, she forgot which. She did some careful calculations with her GPA, which until that point had been highly robust, and figured she could go to school 2 days out of five, eke out straight D's, and still graduate. It was just a matter of careful brinksmanship, and the brink was where Julia lived now. Meanwhile, she continued to see the shrink regularly. He was a perfectly decent sort, nothing if not well-meaning, with a funny, stubbly face and reasonable expectations of what he could hope to achieve in life. She didn't tell him about the secret school for magic that she hadn't gotten into, though. Maybe she was crazy, but she wasn't stupid. She'd seen Terminator 2. She wasn't going out like Sarah Connor. Every once in a while, Julia did feel her conviction slackening. She knew what she knew, but there just wasn't a lot to go on, day to day, to keep her belief in what happened strong. The best she could hope for was that every couple of weeks, Google might pop up a hit on brake bills, maybe two, but a few minutes later it would be gone again, as if by magic. Apparently, she wasn't the only person out there who had a Google alert on it, and that person was clever enough to scrub the Google cache when the alert went off. But it gave Julia something to chew on. Then, in April, they made their first wrong move. They really blew it wide open, because 7 envelopes arrived in her mailbox, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Stanford, MIT, and Caltech. "Congratulations, we are pleased to accept you as a member of the class of..." "You must be fucking kidding me!" She laughed her fucking head off when she saw them. Her parents laughed, too. They were laughing with relief. Julia was laughing because it was so goddamn funny. She kept on laughing as she ripped the letters in half, one after the other, and fed them to the recycling bin. "You goddamned idiots," she thought. "Too clever for your own good. No wonder you let Quentin in. You're just like him. You can't stop outsmarting yourselves. You think you can buy off my life with this? With a bunch of fat envelopes? You are perhaps under the impression that I will accept these in lieu of the magic kingdom that is my rightful inheritance? Oh, my, no, not on your life, mister. This is a standoff, a waiting game, and I've got all day." You're looking for a quick fix to the Julia problem, but no such fix exists. You'd best settle in, my friend, because Julia is playing the long game. Chapter 7. On the way home, Quentin made it his royal business to orbit the Muntjac and check in on everybody once or twice a day. The morning after they left the outer island, Quentin's first stop was Benedict. The ship was racing along under the tropical sun, every line and sail twangingly taut and perfect, and Quentin was feeling a little silly that he'd had the Muntjac so thoroughly fitted out for what had amounted to a trip around the block. He found Benedict sitting on a stool in his cabin, hunched over his tiny fold-down writing desk. Spread out on it was a hand-drawn naval chart, showing a few jagged little islands and peppered with tiny numbers that might have denoted the depths of the ocean. Somebody had gone over the shallow water with a pale blue wash to make it look more watery. Benedict hadn't warmed to Quentin any since they'd left the mainland, but Quentin found himself liking him anyway. There was something bracing about the sheer consistency of his contempt for Quentin, who was, after all, Benedict's king. It took some backbone to stick to that position, and if nothing else, Benedict was about the nerdiest person he'd met in Fillory, of a type that didn't really exist in the real world. He was a map nerd. "What have you been up to?" he said. Benedict shrugged.
"Seasick, mostly."
He hadn't seen much of Benedict, though he'd tried a couple of times to tutor him on his math. Benedict was conspicuously skillful at doing arithmetic in his head, but Philorian mathematics weren't particularly advanced. It was amazing how far he'd gotten on his own. "What are you working on?"
"Old map," Benedict said without looking up. "Like, really old, like 200 years ago."
Quentin peered over his shoulder, hands clasped behind his back. "Is that from the embassy?"
"Like I would do that. It was on the wall, in a frame."
"It's just that it has the Outer Island Embassy seal on it."
"I copied it."
"You copied the seal, too?"
"I copied the map. The seal was on the map."
It was a gorgeous map. If he was telling the truth, Benedict had genuine talent. It was detailed, precise, without any hesitations or erasures. "That's amazing. You have a real gift." Benedict flushed at this and worked even more industriously. He found Quentin's approval and his disapproval equally unbearable. "How have you found the field work? Must be different from what you're used to."
"I hate it," Benedict said. "It's a fucking mess. Nothing looks like it's supposed to. There's no math for it." His frustration brought him out of his shell a little. "Nothing's ever correct, ever. There's no straight lines. I always got that maps are approximations. I just never understood how much they leave out. It's chaos. I'm never doing this again."
"That's it? You're giving up?"
"Why shouldn't I? Look at that."
Benedict waved at the wall in the general direction of the heaving sea.
"And now look at this."
He pointed to the map.
"This, you can make this perfect. That,"
he shuddered,
"it's just a mess."
"But the map isn't real."
"So sure, maybe it's perfect, but what's the point?" "Maps don't make you seasick."
The irony wasn't lost on Quentin. He's the one who'd turned the ship around, back toward Whitespire.
He looked at the map Benedict was working on. Sure enough, one of the little islands toward the edge of the page, almost falling into the margin, had the word "after" written next to it in tiny calligraphic script.
After Island. There it was right there. Quentin touched it lightly with his finger. He half expected to get a shock.
"Is that on our way?"
"It's east of here. It's the complete opposite of on our way."
"How far?"
2 days, 3 days. Like I said, the map is really old, and these are outlying islands."
Benedict explained, rolling his eyes practically up into his head at Quentin's ignorance, that the islands farther out in the Eastern Ocean didn't stay still once they caught on that they'd been mapped. They didn't like it, and through some kind of tectonic magic, they wandered around to make sure the maps didn't stay too accurate. More chaos. Benedict whispered some calculations to himself, speed and time, then nimbly, precisely, you wouldn't think it was possible with those black bangs hanging over his eyes, he drew a perfect freehand circle around After Island in light pencil.
"It has to be somewhere inside this circle."
Quentin gazed at the little island dot, lost in the web of curving lines of meridians and parallels. A net that wouldn't catch him if he fell. It wasn't Fillory out there, but somewhere in that abyss shone a key, a magic key.
He could come back with that in his hand. An image swam into his mind, an album cover from the 1970s, a painting of an old-fashioned sailing ship on the very edge of a cataract over which the green sea was roaring and pouring.
The ship was right on the edge, just beginning to tilt, and the current was strong, but still, a bold tack and a strong wind might just save it. A sharp, barked order from the captain, and it would slew around and beat back up against the current to safety. But then where would the ship go? Back home?
Not yet.
Mind if I borrow this? He said. I want to show it to the captain. With the course change, they left the warm blue-green ocean behind and crashed their way into a heaving black one. The temperature dropped 30 degrees. Flail blows of cold rain clattered on the deck. Quentin couldn't have pointed to the dividing line,
but now the water around them seemed like a completely different element from the one they'd been sailing in before,
something opaque and solid that had to be smashed and shoved aside rather than slipped silently through. The Muntjac bulled its way gamely through the waves, ahead of a firm, pressing salt wind. The ship had a surprise for them. Below the waterline, it seemed, it was hard to see clearly through the chop, to have put out a pair of sleek wooden fins, unfolding from pockets in the hull, which swam them forward.
Whether they were animated by magic or mechanical arrangement, Quentin didn't know, but he felt a warm surge of gratitude. The old ship was repaying his kindness and more.
He thought the Sloth might know something about it, given how much time it spent down there in the hold, but when he visited, he found it fast asleep, hanging by its boathook claws, rocking gently with the ship's rolling. If anything, it was more serene in the heavy weather.
The air in the hold was warm and humid and slothy, and a salad of rotting fruit rinds and less identifiable debris sloshed around in the bilge.
Julia, then. She might know. And he wanted to discuss the magic key with her. She was his only real peer on board the Muntjac, and she had access to sources he didn't, and he was worried about her.
Julia kept to her cabin even more than usual now that the weather had turned.
She may have been spiritually one with Fillory, but the freezing drizzle had hounded even her below decks. Quentin lurched down the narrow passage that led to her room, with errant swells flinging him playfully against one bulkhead, then the other. Her door was shut. For a moment, just as the Muntjac paused weightlessly on the crest of the wave, Quentin had a powerful sense of the romance of the scene, and his crush stirred inside him, unfolding its leathery wings. He knew it was at least partly a fantasy. Julia was so solitary, so wrapped up in Fillory, that it was hard to imagine her wanting him, or anyone, or at any rate anyone human. She was missing something, but it probably wasn't a boyfriend. Then again, they were both here, far out at sea, tempest-tossed, together in a warm berth in the freezing wasteland of the ocean. It was liberating, being out from under the snarky, gossipy gazes of Elliot and Janet. Surely Julia couldn't be so far gone that she didn't recognize the allure of a shipboard fling. The scene practically wrote itself. She was only human.
And they would be home soon.
He knocked on her door.
Always at the back of his mind, never spoken but always felt, was his awareness that Julia was from before. Before breakbills. Before he knew magic was real. Before everything. She'd never known Alice. If he could fall back in love with Julia, it would be like time winding itself back, and he could start over again. Sometimes he wasn't sure if he was in love with Julia, or just that he wanted to be in love with her, because it would be so comforting, such a relief, to be in love with her. It seemed like such a good idea. Was there really that big of a difference?
Julia opened the door. She was naked. Or, no, she wasn't naked. She was wearing a dress, sort of, but only to her waist. The top half was hanging down in front of her, and her breasts were bare. They were pale and conical, neither full nor slight. They were perfect. When he was 17, he'd devoted entire months of his life to constructing a mental image of Julia's naked upper body based on forensic evidence gathered from furtive surveys of her clothed form. As it turned out, he'd been quite close. Only her nipples were different from what he'd expected, paler, hardly darker than the pale skin around them. He closed the door again, He didn't slam it, but he closed it firmly.
"Jesus Christ, Julia,"
he said under his breath, though he said it to himself more than to her. A long minute passed. He spent it with his back against the bulkhead next to Julia's door. He could feel his heart beating hard against the hard wood.
Sure, he'd wanted something to happen, but not that, or at least not like that. What the hell did she mean, waving those things around? What, was this a joke to her?
He could hear her moving around in her room. He took a deep breath and knocked again, slowly. When she answered the door again, her dress was fully on.
"What the hell are you doing?"
he said. "Sorry," she said flatly. She sat down on a little stool at the other end of the room, facing the windows. She didn't ask him in, but she hadn't closed the door either. Warily, he stepped inside. Julia's quarters were the mirror image of Quentin's, but due to an irregularity in the ship's plan, an errant staircase on his side, they were a little bigger, with room for two people to sit if one of them sat on the bed. Quentin sat on the bed. Light came from a glowing blue ball that bobbed up against the ceiling like a balloon that had lost its string, an odd casting of Julia's that looked like a trapped will-o'-the-wisp.
"I'm sorry," she said again. "I forgot."
"What did you forget?"
It came out angrier than he meant it to.
"That your arms go in the sleeves? Look, it's not like I don't..."
No good end to that sentence.
"Never mind."
He looked at her, really looked, for the first time in a while. She was still beautiful, but thin, much too thin, and her eyes were still black. He wondered if the change was permanent, and if so, what else had changed that he couldn't see?
"I don't know."
She stared out at the spray.
"I forget what I forgot."
"Well, okay, so... but now you remembered."
"Look, I forget how things work sometimes, all right?
Or not so much how, but why. Why people say hello. Why they take baths. Why they wear clothes. Read books, smile, talk, eat. All those human things."
She tugged her mouth to one side.
"I don't understand this, Julia."
The anger was gone. He kept revising how much trouble Julia was having, and every time he did, he revised it upward.
"Help me understand. You're human. Why would you forget that? How would you?" "I don't know."
She shook her head. Then she turned those black eyes on him.
"I'm losing it. It's losing me. It's going away."
"What is?
What happened to you, Julia?
Do you need to go back to Earth?"
"No," she said sharply.
"I'm not going back there. Not ever." The idea seemed to frighten her.
"But you remember Brooklyn, right? Where we're from? And James and high school and all that?"
"Remembering."
Her delicate mouth quirked again bitterly. She spoke in something like her old voice, with contractions and everything.
"That's always been my problem, hasn't it? I remembered brake bills. Couldn't forget it."
Quentin remembered her remembering. She'd failed the entrance exam at brake bills, which he'd passed, and she was supposed to forget about it afterward, so the school would stay secret. They'd cast spells on her to make sure. But the spells hadn't held, and she hadn't forgotten. But it had brought her here, he reminded himself, to a beautiful ship on a magical ocean. It had made her a queen of a secret world. The path was crooked, but it led to a happy ending, right? It was dawning on him that Fillory was his happy ending, but it might not be Julia's. She needed something else. She was still out there on the crooked path, and night was coming on.
"Do you wish you hadn't remembered brake bills? Do you wish you'd stayed in Brooklyn?" "Sometimes,"
She folded her arms and leaned back against the wall of her cabin in a way that couldn't have been comfortable.
"Quentin, why didn't you help me? Why didn't you rescue me when I came to you for help that day in Chesterton?"
It was a fair question. It's not like he'd never asked himself that before. He'd even come up with some good answers.
"I couldn't, Julia. It wasn't my choice. You know that. I couldn't get you into break bills. I barely got myself in. But you could have come to see me, showed me what you knew. They would have expelled me. Then, after you graduated, why are you still talking about this now, Julia?"
Knowing he was on shaky ground, Quentin counterattacked. "Your best defense is a good offense. Look, you asked me to tell them about you. I did what you asked. I told them. I thought they'd found you and wiped your memory. That's what they always do."
"But they didn't. They couldn't find me. By the time they came looking for me, I was long gone, into thin air." She snapped her fingers. "Like magic."
"And anyway, Julia, how is it supposed to work?
What were you going to be, the sorcerer's apprentice, like Mickey Mouse? And how do you think I felt about it? You didn't used to give a shit about me, then suddenly I'm Spelly McSpell and you're all over me. That's just not how it works."
"I gave a shit about you, I just didn't want to sleep with you. God!" She rounded on him in the narrow space. She'd been leaning the stool back on two legs, and now it clunked back down onto four. "Though, by the way, I would have, if you'd just given me what I needed."
"Well, you got it anyway, didn't you?"
"Oh, sure I did. I got it, and a whole lot more. You shouldn't be surprised about any of this, you of all people. You abandoned me out there in the real world, without magic. Everything that happened to me started with you. You want to know what it was? I'll tell you, but not until you've earned it."
A heavy silence hung in the room. Outside, night was falling hard on the stone-colored waves, and her little window was splashed with seawater.
"I never wanted this for you, Julia. Whatever it is. I'm sorry."
He had to say it, and it was true, but it wasn't the only truth. There were other truths in there that weren't as attractive, such as he'd been angry at Julia. He'd been her lapdog in high school, trailing around after her while she screwed his best friend, and he'd quite enjoyed it when the tables turned. Was that why he hadn't rescued Julia? It wasn't the only reason, but it was a reason.
"I felt like myself again," she said dully. "Just then, when I got angry."
The window pane was beginning to mist over. Julia started drawing a shape on it, then scribbled it out.
"It's going now."
Never mind the magic key. This was where his attention should be. Julia didn't need his love. She needed his help.
"Help me understand," he said. He gathered up her cold fingers in his. "Tell me what I can do. I want to help you. I want to help you remember."
Something else was glowing in the room, something besides the blue will-o'-the-wisp. He wasn't sure when it had started. It was Julia, or not Julia, something inside her. Her heart was glowing. He could see it right through her skin, even through her dress.
"I am remembering, Quentin," she said. "Out here on the ocean, away from Fillory, it's coming back to me."
Now she smiled brightly, and it was worse than when she just looked blank.
"I am remembering so much that I never even knew before."
That night, after a heavy nautical dinner, Quentin went below and unfolded his pallet from against the wall and put himself to bed. The cold, the darkness, the weather, his interview with Julia, everything had combined to accelerate time to the point where he felt like he'd been awake for a week. It wasn't the hours, it was the mileage. He stared up at the rough red-brown beams over his head in the swaying light of the oil lamp.
He was cold and sticky with salt. He could have washed. He knew how to make fresh water from salt.
But the spell was involved, and his fingers were stiff, and he decided he would rather live with the stickiness. He was warming up under the blankets anyway. When he'd come aboard, he'd found a regulation navy blanket on the bed, a bristly beast that weighed about 10 pounds and could have repelled chain shot. It was like being in bed with the corpse of a wild boar.
He'd swapped it out for a foot-thick down comforter that was persistently damp and thoroughly non-regulation, but infinitely more comforting.
Quentin waited to see if his mind would tip over into sleep. When it didn't, and it had made it clear that it wasn't going to without a fight, he sat up and looked at the books on the bookshelves. In his old life, at a juncture like this one, he would have reached for a Fillory novel, but events had overtaken that particular pleasure. But there was still the book Elaine had given him, The Seven Golden Keys. Seven. That was more golden keys than he'd bargained for. He would settle for just one. The book wasn't a novel, it turned out, just a fairy tale set in large type with woodcut illustrations, a children's book.
She must have filched it from Eleanor. What a piece of work that woman was.
The back page bore the stamp of the embassy library. He squinched up his pillow enough to prop up his head. The story was about a man, his daughter, and a witch. He was a widower, and the daughter was hardly more than a toddler when the witch came through town. Jealous of the little girl's beauty, and with no children of her own, the witch stole her away, cackling as she did, that she was going to lock her away in a silver castle on a remote island. The man could free his daughter, but only if he could find the key to the castle, which he never would, because it was at the end of the world. Undaunted, the man set out to find the key. It was hot, and he walked all day, and as the sun set, he stopped by a river to refresh himself. When he bent down to drink, he heard a tiny voice calling, "Open me up! Open me up!" He looked around, and soon he saw that the voice belonged to a freshwater oyster that was clinging to a rock in the river. Next to it, in the river mud, was a minuscule golden key. The man picked up both oyster and key, and sure enough, there was a tiny keyhole in the oyster shell on the opposite side from the hinge. He fitted the key into the lock and turned it, and the shell began to open. He worked it farther open with his knife. As he did so, the oyster died, as oysters will when their shells are opened. Inside the oyster, in the place where a pearl might have been, was another golden key, slightly larger than the first one. The man ate the oyster and took the key and went on his way. Soon he arrived at a house in a forest, and he knocked on the door to see if the owners could give him shelter for the night. The door was slightly ajar, so he pushed his way inside. He found the house full of beds. Every room was crammed with them, and in each bed a man or a woman was sleeping. He strolled through the house until he finally found an empty one for himself. There was a clock on the wall that had run down. There was no key to wind it with, so he used the key he found in the oyster's shell, and then he went to bed. In the morning the clock struck 7, and he awoke. So did the other sleepers in the house. Each of them repeated the same story. They'd come to the house as strangers and taken beds for the night, but they appeared to have slept for years and years, in some cases centuries, right up until the clock struck. As the man packed up his things, he found a golden key under his pillow, slightly larger than the one he had used to wind the clock. It grew colder as the man walked. Perhaps it was colder everywhere since his daughter had been put in the castle. In time, the man met a beautiful woman sitting in a pavilion, weeping because her harp was out of tune. He gave her the golden key to tune her harp, and she gave him a larger one in exchange. That one turned out to be the key to a chest buried under a tree root with yet another, still larger key inside, which led him into a castle, but not the castle with his daughter in it, with a key resting on a table in the highest room of the tallest tower. The man walked and walked for weeks or months or years. He couldn't tell anymore. When he couldn't walk anymore, he sailed, and when he couldn't sail anymore, he was at the end of the world, where sat a dignified man in a dinner suit, dangling his long legs over the edge. He was patting his lapels and turning out his pockets and looking generally perplexed.
"Bother," said the well-dressed man, "I've lost the key to the world. If I don't wind it up and set its clockwork going again, the sun and moon and stars won't turn, and the world will be plunged into an eternal night-time of miserable cold and darkness. Bother!"
Being a hero, the man had observed, is largely a matter of knowing one's cues. Without a word, he drew out the key he'd found in the castle.
"Oh, the devil!" the man said. "Well, bother, give it here."
He took the key and lay full length on the ground, mussing his fine suit, and reached his arm over the very edge of the world and began winding vigorously. A loud ratcheting sound could be heard.
"It's in my back pocket," he called over his shoulder as he worked. "You'll have to get it yourself."
Hesitantly, the man reached into the pocket. The well-dressed man never stopped winding, and drew out the last key. He retreated to his boat and sailed back the way he came. A short time later, a surprisingly short time, he arrived at the magical castle where the witch had imprisoned his daughter. How long ago he could no longer tell. It really was an impressive affair, with gleaming silver walls that flashed in the sun, and it floated some ways off the ground, so that you had to ascend to it by way of a narrow, winding silver staircase that flexed disquietingly when the wind blew. The gate was black iron. The man fitted the last key into the lock and turned it. The moment he finished, the doors sprang open to reveal a beautiful woman standing right behind them, just as if she'd been waiting there for him all along. She was as tall as he was, and she must have been doing a great deal of studying with the witch while he was gone, because she absolutely glowed with magical power. But he still recognized her. She was his daughter.
"Beautiful girl," the man said. "It's me, your father. I've come to take you home."
"My father?" she said. "You're not my father. My daddy's not an old man."
The beautiful woman cackled a not unfamiliar cackle.
"But I am your father," he said. "You don't understand. I've been searching all this time."
The woman wasn't listening.
"But thank you anyway for setting me free." She kissed him on the cheek. Then she handed him a golden key and flew away on the wind.
"Wait!"
he called after her. But she didn't wait.
He couldn't explain.
He watched her dwindle in the distance into nothing. Only then did he sit down and weep. The man never saw his daughter again, and he never used the key either. Because where could he have gone? What door could he have opened? What treasure could he have unlocked that would have been worth more to him than the golden key his daughter gave him?
Chapter 8 Quentin was woken up early by the lookout calling out sonorously to the helmsman, like a subway conductor announcing the next stop, that land was in sight. He put a heavy black cloak on over his pajamas and went up on deck. His dreams had been full of the man and the daughter and the witch and the keys. The story bothered him, not least because he didn't think it really would have ended that way. Could the man really not have explained? Did his daughter really not understand what had happened? It didn't add up. If they'd talked about it and figured things out, it could have been a happy ending. People in fairy tales never just figured things out. The clouds hung low and gray and solid, barely higher than the top of the Muntjac's main mast. Quentin squinted in the direction the lookout was pointing. There it was. The promised island was barely visible through the mist, still hours away. Up on the forecastle deck, Bingle was going through his morning exercises. Quentin's limited interactions with him had made him worry that the greatest swordsman in all of Fillory might possibly be clinically depressed. He never laughed. or even smiled.
Two swords lay beside him, still in their leather sheaths, while he performed a series of what looked like isometric exercises involving only his hands, not totally unlike the finger exercises Quentin had learned at Breakbills. He wondered how you got to be as good at fighting as Bingle. If he was going to get any further in the adventuring business, Quentin thought, he should look into it. He liked the idea of it, a sword-fighting sorcerer, the double threat. He didn't have to get as good as Bingle, he just had to get better than he was, which was none too good. A sword-fighting sorcerer, the double threat. "Good morning," Quentin called.
"Good morning, Your Highness," Bingle said.
He never made the mistake of calling Quentin Your Majesty, a form of address that was reserved for the High King. "I hate to interrupt." Bingle didn't stop his routine, which Quentin supposed meant he wasn't technically interrupting after all. He climbed the short ladder up to where Bingle was standing. Bingle knotted his hands together, then turned the position inside out in a move that made even Quentin wince.
"I was thinking maybe you could give me some lessons in swordsmanship. I've had a few already, but I haven't gotten very far."
Bingle's expression didn't change.
"It will be easier to protect you," he said, "if you can protect yourself."
"That was my thinking." Bingle unwove his fingers, which took some careful doing, and looked Quentin up and down. He reached forward and slid Quentin's sword out of its sheath. He did this so quickly and fluidly that although Quentin thought he probably could have stopped him, he had a few inches of reach on Bingle, he couldn't have sworn to it. Bingle examined Quentin's sword, first one side, then the other, felt its edge and its heft, pouting thoughtfully.
"I'll provide you with a weapon."
"I already have a weapon," Quentin pointed. "That sword.
It's beautiful, but not right for a beginner."
For a second, Quentin thought he was going to do something drastic, like chuck it overboard, but he just placed it on the deck next to the two other swords.
"I'll provide you with a weapon."
Bingle went below and returned to present Quentin with the training sword he would be using, a short, heavy weapon of oiled steel, blunt and nearly black and devoid of any adornment whatsoever. The blade and the hilt were all made out of one single, unbroken chunk of metal. It was the most industrial-looking object Quentin had ever seen in Fillory. It weighed half again what his sword weighed. It didn't even come with a scabbard, so he wouldn't get to show off his buff, sheathing, unsheathing skills.
"Hold it straight out," Bingle said. "Like this."
He straightened Quentin's elbow and brought his arm up parallel to the deck. Quentin was holding the thing at full extension. He could already feel his muscles starting to cramp.
"Point it straight forward. Keep it out there, long as you can."
Quentin was expecting further instructions, but Bingle calmly went back to his isometrics. Quentin's arm stiffened, then glowed with pain, then caught fire. He lasted about 2 minutes. Bingle had him switch arms.
"What do you call this style?" Quentin asked. "The mistake people make," Bingle said, "is thinking that there are different styles."
"All right."
"Force, balance, leverage, momentum. These principles never change. They are your style."
Quentin was pretty sure his knowledge of physics exceeded Bingle's by a couple of orders of magnitude, but he'd never thought of applying it that way. Bingle explained that rather than practice a single fighting technique, his technique was to master all techniques and to deploy them as circumstances and terrain required. A single grand meta-technique, if you will. He'd wandered Fillory and the lands beyond for years, seeking out martial monks in mountain monasteries and street fighters in crowded medinas, and extracting their secrets until he became the man Quentin saw before him, a walking encyclopedia of swordsmanship. Of the oaths he had made and broken, the beautiful women he had seduced and betrayed to obtain these secrets, it was best not to speak.
Quentin switched arms again, and then again. It reminded him of his days as a semi-pro sleight-of-hand magician. The beginning, the laying down of the fundamentals, was always the worst part, which he supposed was why so few people did it. That was the thing about the world. It wasn't that things were harder than you thought they were going to be. It was that they were hard in ways that you didn't expect. To take his mind off it, he watched Bingle, who was now stalking the deck, staring accusingly ahead of him, whipping his own blade in a complicated pattern, drawing ampersands and Kell's knots in the air with it. A frigid, spitting mist was blowing in from the ocean. He could see After Island clearly now. They'd be landing soon. He decided he was done. He should at least change out of his pajamas before he set off in search of the golden key. "I'm knocking off, Bingle," he said. He placed his practice blade on the deck next to Bingle's other two. His arms felt like they were floating. Bingle nodded, not breaking his own rhythm. "Come back to me when you can do half an hour," he said, "with each arm." He performed a spectacular no-handed round-off that looked like it was going to take him right off the forecastle deck, but somehow he swallowed his inertia just in time to stick the landing. He finished with his blade jammed between the ribs of some imaginary assailant. He withdrew it and cleaned the blade on his pants leg. That was probably a few more lessons down the track. "Be careful what you learn from me," he said. "What is written with a sword cannot be erased." "That's why I have you," Quentin said, "so I won't have to write anything with my sword. Sometimes I think I am fate's sword. She wields me cruelly." Quentin wondered what it was like to be so unselfconsciously melodramatic. Nice, probably. "Right. Well, there won't be much cruelty on this trip. We'll be back at Whitespire pretty soon. Then you can go check out your castle." Bingle turned to face the wind. He seemed to be living out some story of his own, in which Quentin was just a minor character, a chorus member, without even a name in the program. "I shall never see Fillory again." In spite of himself, Quentin felt a chill. He didn't like the feeling. He was chilly enough as it was. After Island was a low strip of gray rocks and thin grass flocked with sheep. If the Outer Island was a tropical paradise, After could have passed for a stray member of the Outer Hebrides. They circled it, hugging the shore, until they found a harbor and dropped anchor. A couple of rain-ravaged fishing boats were moored there, and a handful of empty buoys suggested that more were out to sea. It was a hell of a dreary spot. A more enterprising king might have tried to claim it for Fillory, Quentin supposed, except that it didn't really seem worth it. Not exactly the jewel in the crown. There was no wharf, and the bay was crowded with surly breakers. They barely managed to get the launch in past the surf without swamping. Quentin jumped out, wetting himself to the waist, and wallowed up onto the rocky beach. A couple of fishermen watched them, smoking and mending a vast, tangled net that was stretched out around them on the shale. They had the brick-red complexions of lifelong outdoorsmen, and they shared the same thick-headed look. They didn't seem to have enough forehead. Their hairlines were pulled down too low over their eyebrows. Quentin would have put their age at anything between 30 and 60. "Ahoy there," he said. They nodded at him and grunted. One of them touched his cap. Over a few minutes' parley, the friendly one was persuaded to divulge the general direction of the nearest and probably only town. Quentin, Bingle, and Benedict thanked the men and slogged their way up the beach through the cold white sand, scalloped with black tide marks. Julia trailed silently behind them. Quentin had tried to persuade her to stay on board, but she insisted. Whatever else was going on with her, she was still up for a party. "You know what I'm waiting for on this trip?" Quentin said. "I'm not waiting for somebody to be happy to see us. I just want someone to look surprised to see us." The weather deepened to a light, wuthering rain. Quentin's wet pants chafed. The sand gave way to dunes, capped with sawgrass, and then to a path. Grassy sand, then sandy grass, then just grass. They tramped through humpy, unfenced meadows and low hills, past a lost, orphaned well. He tried to summon a heroic feeling, but the setting wasn't especially conducive. It reminded him of nothing so much as walking along Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn in the freezing rain with James and Julia on the day he took his brake bills exam.
In olden times there was a boy, young and strong and brave-o.
The town, once they found it, was a thoroughly medieval affair of stone cottages, thatched roofs, and mud streets. Its most marked characteristic was the thorough lack of interest the locals showed in the oddly dressed strangers in their midst. A half-dozen of them were sitting at an outdoor table in front of a pub. They were eating sandwiches and drinking beer out of metal tankards, in the face of weather Quentin would have made it a major priority to get out of. "Hi," he said. Chorus of grunts. "I'm Quentin. I'm from Fillory. We've come to your island in search of a key." He glanced at the others and coughed once. It was pretty much impossible to do this without sounding like he was reciting a Monty Python sketch. "Do you know anything about that? The magic key, made of gold?" They looked at each other and nodded. "Agreed, we all know what he's talking about." They shared a family resemblance. They could all have been brothers.
"Aye, we know the one you mean,"
one of them said, a large, brutal-looking man encased in a huge woolly coat. His hand on his knee was like a piece of pink granite.
"It's down the road."
"Down the road," Quentin repeated. "Right. Of course, the golden key is down the road. Where else would it be?" He wondered where this feeling was coming from that he was improvising his part in a play that everybody else had a script for.
"Aye, we know it," he jerked his head. "Down the road."
"All right, down the road it is. Well, thank you very much." He wondered if it was ever warm and sunny here, or if they lived in the permanent equivalent of a New England November. Did they know they were 3 days' sail from a tropical zone? The travelers set off down the road. They would have looked nobler if they'd been riding horses instead of wallowing through the mud like a bunch of peasants, but the Muntjac wasn't set up for horses. Maybe they could hire local horses. Shaggy, sturdy ponies resigned to always being cold and damp and to never being sleek and beautiful. He missed Dauntless. The street changed to cobbles, rounded cubes that turned slick and ankle-breaking in the drizzle. It wasn't much of a setting for a quest or an adventure or even an errand. Maybe Bingle was right. Maybe they were just minor characters in his drama. Benedict wasn't even taking notes the way he usually did.
"I'll just remember it," he said.
There you had it. An island not even Benedict would bother to map. It wasn't a large town, and it wasn't a long road. The last building on it was a stone building like a church, though it wasn't a church, just a boxy structure 2 stories high, built up out of flat, gray, local stones, unmortared. It had a blank facade that looked unfinished, or maybe whatever ornamentation had once been there had been stripped away. Quentin felt like the little boy at the beginning of The Lorax, at the mysterious tower of the dismal Onceler. They should have been facing down bellowed challenges from black knights bearing the Vergescu, or solving thorny theological dilemmas posed by holy hermits, or at the very least resisting the diabolical temptations of ravishing succubi. Not fighting off seasonal affective disorder. If he'd had to put his finger on it, he would have said that, more than anything else, the rhythm of it was wrong. It was too soon. They shouldn't have found it this quick, nor should they obtain it without a fight. But fuck it. Maybe he was just lucky. Maybe it was destiny. In spite of everything, he felt a rising excitement. This was it. The doors were enormous and made of oak, but there was a smaller, man-sized door set in one of them, presumably for days when you couldn't be bothered to fling open an entire, grand, double-height oaken portal. The doorway was flanked by empty niches for statuary,